This past week, probably many of us were glued to one news source or another in regard to the aftermath of the hurricane. I appreciate Gail's comments. I thought I would just kind of continue the sermonette into the sermon in some respects. The hurricane that came in, Katrina, was out in the ocean, a Category 5 hurricane, the worst category there is. Winds reached up to 165 miles an hour out over the water. And the swath of territory in any direction that the hurricane force winds existed was up to 100 miles out to each side. So it was a very, very huge swath of territory that would be impacted. There were some weather changes as the storm approached land, and it actually reduced its velocity down to a Category 4 storm before it hit landfall. The problem is the seawalls and the berms and the levees all around New Orleans were designed for a Category 3 hurricane. They simply weren't designed to withstand a direct hit or even a glancing major blow from a major hurricane. 500,000 people living in the city, another 1 million people living in the suburbs in the area right around the city, and even the levee system was not designed to break the city up into parts. There's more than one levee, but the main part of the city is all encompassed in a single area. It was an absolute disaster waiting to happen. And as we've all watched it again on our TVs, reading about it in the news, the circumstances are very, very dramatic. Numerous church members in the course of discussing the events and what's happening have looked at that and then commented that they felt like they were watching a precursor to what would happen in the end time. Anarchy, chaos, civil disobedience, one person taking advantage of another. Now, in all fairness, the news is first going to show the trauma. The good news, the heroism, the valor, I believe will come out of this circumstance, but we won't hear about it till later. We'll read about it in Reader's Digest. We'll see it brought around later. There'll be many, many illustrations of heroism and valor that come out of this circumstance as well, but we're simply not going to hear about it quite yet. If you watch the film that came out of the crowds of people in the video from the Superdome, it was almost gang rule in some respects inside the Superdome at times. The Superdome has almost totally, not completely I don't think, but almost totally been evacuated. But what we haven't seen video of is the convention center where there's another 10, 15, or 20,000. I think it was closer to 20,000 people stuffed into the convention center. I read one article of a journalist that was making his way there and passed a resident on the side of the street. And the resident said, well, I hope you're strapped. You know, hope you're carrying a weapon if you're going to go over there. You know, it's for those that maybe have seen little clips from time to time in the advertisements, but it almost, in my mind, seemed like something out of an old Mad Max film, if you have any concept of what was portrayed there. Kind of society breaking down in on itself. It's a pretty traumatic circumstance. The police, the emergency services, the medical personnel, all of them were overwhelmed, and very quickly. There's a commentary on United's website by Don Hooser, and he describes a little bit about what happens to social structure under severe crisis such as this. He says, modern high-tech civilization is wonderful when all the complex interdependent services and infrastructure are functioning. But when they fail, citizens dependent on these things are trapped, largely unprepared and helpless to survive. You know, in the Depression in the 30s, the people were still on the land. Agriculture was still a basis for our economy. People on the farms didn't have any cash. And unless they lived in Oklahoma, where there was maybe no moisture or ability to function and they had to move in some respects, but if you look at the map of the Depression, there was a booming economy in the Northwest because of timber and some mining. And even along the California coast, because of the orchard and the fruit and some of the local economy, there were still places where the economy was strong, even through the Depression, or at least where there were jobs available. But the people who lived on the land, unless they were right in the heart of the area that was so devastated by the drought, they had food. They could prepare and care for themselves. They just didn't have any cash because the economy itself had faltered. When you get into an economy such as what we have, this high-tech civilization, as Mr. Hoosier references, when the system fails, you suffer the loss of communication, transportation, mail, medical care, and then the suffering increases exponentially. Again, member after member after member in commenting and watching the TV has said they felt like they were looking at a little preview of what happens when society is structurally destroyed, and on what we might see on a larger scale someday. It's a pretty dramatic rendering, and it's a taste of something that none of us really wants to have. When I was in my 20s in college and I began to think about the end time and the fact that I could be alive when Christ returned, and I thought, I want to be there. I'm not saying I wanted to be at the resurrection. I did want that. No, I wanted to be part of the process where you walked into that time. Boy, it must be nice to be young. The naivete and the zeal and the energy of a 20-year-old looking at the end time. I look at that now and I think, boy, I sure don't want to face that. I don't want to be there. Life is different. Mr. Hoosier goes on, no water for drinking and washing and flushing toilets, no food, no electricity, which means no way to preserve perishable food, power gasoline pumps, get relief from the heat and humidity, or recharge cell phone batteries, no schools, no jobs, no income. These are a few ways in which we are highly vulnerable to both natural disasters and to terrorism. He says, with each world disaster, we can't help wonder if God had a part in it. You can process that, and we don't have the answer except that God does warn us that there will be increasing disasters. And some of that comes as a judgment. Some of that comes because of man's own foolishness. If you build a city in a bathtub, and you build up dikes for a Category 3 hurricane, sooner or later, you know the dikes are going to burst. They have to. And if the federal economy is such that you make requests constantly and consistently to the Civil Corps of Engineers or whomever to build up your dikes and refurbish them to withstand a greater storm, and the federal government says, I'm sorry, we don't have budget for that right now, then your protection is never built. It can't last. Our economy, our society, the immorality and the self-centeredness of our society is a house of cards. And we know that in the church. But life goes on. I go out in my yard and I look and the grass is green and the bushes and flowers are all up and in abundance and the gas station is only two or three blocks away. And the gas might be $3 a gallon, which means you can forget about ever seeing my Suburban come down to Lewiston or Kennewick or anywhere else again. I called Pendleton this week and talked to somebody there, Mr. Hodgson. He's been here once or twice for church. And I says, well, I'm not coming. We'll just have to talk by phone right now. I used to be able to say, well, I think I'll run down to Pendleton. And I'll visit and take care of some needs there and help where I can. And literally now I say, you know what? I don't think I will do that. I just can't do it the same way under those circumstances. Hours before landfall, Katrina took a sudden unexpected turn to the east from its projected course so that it did not hit New Orleans directly. Just before landfall, it also unexplainedly reduced in intensity from Category 5 to Category 4. Did God intervene to mute the storm's devastating impact on those who have not heeded the many warnings and pleas to evacuate the entire coastal region? Perhaps so. Though God allows disasters to occur, He is also very merciful. The Bible is full of promises to those who call on God sincerely, especially those who seek to do His will. They may be the beneficiaries indeed of His miraculous care and blessings, even when disaster and disease is all around them. I tried to picture the people in New Orleans wading out through the rivers and lakes of water that fills their city. You know, the residents were told to assemble at the Superdome with 5 days' food and water and medical supplies. And when they were washed away and the people wandered in there, they didn't have even their present needs. There are possibly thousands of people, yes, left indeed, waiting to be rescued. Thousands and thousands of people remaining out there waiting to be rescued. Those people standing on the overpasses that rise out of the water, what do you think they're drinking? What do you think they're drinking after the water they had in their hand ran out? And nobody could bring them any more. And they're thirsty. They're drinking out of that sewer that is the lake that filled their city. You got to know that. The one that the bodies are floating by. They're drinking out of that lake. This is a terrible situation. Mr. Huza goes on and quotes David out of the 23rd Psalm. It says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. It says, no doubt there will be countless stories of prayers answered during the fury of Katrina and additional reports of miraculous deliverance. He says, the great lesson we can learn from the Katrina disaster is that we should not be taking the life and blessings that God has given us for granted. It is good to constantly remind ourselves, and this is the point I would say that I want to address the most closely in my sermon. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and His ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. 1 Peter 3, verse number 12. Do you really want to walk through the disasters and troubles and the risks that we face without the direct and constant and divine intervention and strength and protection that is available to us? Do we want to face these kinds of circumstances without being right with God? It is an incredibly important question, I believe, to ask at this time. There was another article I pulled off the CBS News. It was quoting some of the individuals that were down there. This was actually written prior to the storm landing, or just as the storm came ashore. It says, Hurricane Katrina came ashore just east of Grand Isle, Louisiana, 6:30 a.m. It said, New Orleans is said to be 80% evacuated with potential for historic damage. So the storm hadn't hit New Orleans yet. Evacuations were also ordered in Alabama and Mississippi. It says, because of its size, with hurricane force winds, they extend up to 105 miles from the center, 105 miles in all directions. Hurricane force winds, plus tornadoes are spawned around the sides. Hundreds of thousands in three states heeded official advice Sunday to evacuate. Heading out, gave various quotes. One of the individuals, Nancy Noble, said this, have God on your side. Definitely have God on your side. As she sat with her puppy and friends in six lanes of one-way traffic gridlocked on Interstate 10 in Louisiana. I'm really scared, said Linda Young, as she filled her gas tank near New Orleans. I've been through hurricanes, but this one scares me. I think everyone needs to get out. The mayor said that we're facing a storm that most of us have long feared in ordering the mandatory evacuation for his city. The storm surge will most likely topple our levee system. Before the storm hit, the mayor knew the storm surge would topple their levee system, that the damage was going to be done. He ordered mandatory evacuation. Some people were simply not in a position or chose not to leave. Conceding that as many as 100,000 inner city residents did not have the means to leave, and an untold number of tourists were stranded by the closing of the airport, the city arranged buses to take people to 10 last resort shelters, including the Superdome. Despite the dire predictions, a group of residents in a poor neighborhood of central New Orleans sat on a porch with no car, no way out, and surprisingly, no fear. "We're not evacuating," says 57-year-old Julie Paul. "None of us have any place to go. We're counting on the Superdome. That's our lifesaver." How would you like to be able to count on the Superdome as your lifesaver? We see things in a way that society as a whole may not. I think we've looked for years, sometimes maybe consistently prematurely, for Christ's return. But we do know the prophecies. We do know there will be troubles such as there's never been before, and that we will be walking up through some of those times, I believe, in the lifetime that we have yet ahead of us. Comment was read from Andy Burnett, pastoring there in the congregation in New Orleans. Other Church of God groups have groups there. They must. I don't know exactly how many they might be. Everyone didn't leave. Mr. Burnett has only been able to make contact with about half of his congregation. Some of the congregation, they simply do not yet know what has happened to them. I would say this. I hope that none of them had their faith in the Superdome, because the Superdome didn't exactly turn out to be the kind of solution they had hoped for. We've all seen natural disasters over the years. We've watched them play out at a distance. And yet, no matter what is shown on TV or how graphic it gets, it's sanitized. If you're not actually on the overpass out of your own water and looking at the sewer for a place to drink, there's no way to really comprehend what those people are going through. The tsunami that we saw last December in Indonesia, do you remember how many people died from that? 250,000 died. And millions more were actually displaced. Now, there have been a number of circumstances, big earthquakes and floods that took out the same number of people as that. They're in our lifetime in Bangladesh. And if we stretched back maybe to the lifetime of some of our older members, 1931 in China, there was a huge flood on the Yangtze River. 3 million people died. Took out the crops, killed many people in the flood, and then the rest were starved. But I'm not talking about warfare. I'm not talking about Stalin. I'm not talking about, you know, Pol Pot. I'm just talking about what we call natural disasters. As again, I suppose if you're built below the sea level and your dike breaks, that's a natural expectation that's going to fill up. When we lived in Nebraska, you know, it's easy to say, why would you live there? I can even say that. I've been down on Bourbon Street. Is it Bourbon Street in the French Quarter? I've been on a Bourbon Street when back in the bad old days. And I have no reason to ever go back. And I can easily say, you know, why would anybody live there? But you know, when I lived in California, people said, why would anybody live there? Because of the earthquakes. And I sat in my office and listened to the creaking and groaning of the popping of the ceiling tiles in the building during the earthquake, and it was too much bother to get up and leave your desk because it happened on a regular basis. It was simply no big deal to watch the curtains behind me sway on the wall and the building pop and creak. You know, when we lived in Nebraska, people said, why would you live there? Because the tornadoes had come rolling through just outside of Omaha on a, we call it Tornado Alley, and the storms ran right up this crease in the land there, and there were church members that lived out in property in those places, and these tornadoes would come through and take out this town one day and this town the next day, and then next year was okay, and the year that followed you'd lose a few more. Shell used to really get angry at me because I would sit out in the front yard and watch the funnel clouds. And I've joked about that. We used to always go to bed clothed so that we wouldn't be on news in our underwear. But, you know, I got to where, to me, it was sport to watch the funnel clouds. And you just got used to it. Didn't pay them that much attention. You know, the green and that coloring in the sky and the way the cloud shapes and the swirling. And people say, well, why would you live there? Well, there's all kinds of disasters and risks in all kinds of places. There are people that say, why would we live up here by volcanoes? And we could say, well, nothing ever happens. Right. Mount St. Helens, do we realize that the landslide in Mount St. Helens is the largest landslide when it blew? You know, what happened is the top of that thing shifted off the top and released the pressure before it blew. So it didn't just blow it off. It kind of caused an earthquake and a landslide. Then the volcano blew as a result. That landslide is the largest landslide in the world in any of the church members' lifetime, in the last century. That is the largest landslide in the world. That was not an incidental event. Now, what if that happened on Mount Rainier? And what if the slide went to the west instead of to the east? I mean, Seattle lays right there below that. There just happens to be a bulge on the side of Mount Rainier. And they've kind of watched the bulge. There's a bulge in the bottom of the lake in Yellowstone Park that they watch. It comes up and goes down. And Yellowstone is a super caldera, which is one of a few in the entire world. And somehow the United States seems to be blessed with, I forget, two or three of the super calderas in the whole world, and there's only maybe six or seven in the world, and half of them are in the United States. I go, that's interesting. You know, how do we get the super calderas? They say the blast zone, basically the effective immediate zone of death, if the caldera in Yellowstone blows, is about 500 miles, which means we're okay, because I think it's just over that to Spokane. So we're probably just fine. I mean, just imagine, people say, well, why would you live in Yellowstone? Well, at least you wouldn't suffer any. You know, talk about going to heaven. You know, you're there. So there's all kinds of risk. Do we want to face the kinds of risks without being right with God? Don't we know in our heart, and more than that, don't we know in a yearning, desperate sense that we need to be under God's care? We should. Matthew 24. I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to say the sky is falling. I'm just trying to say God called us for a purpose. He warns us about things to come. We look around the earth and we see things happening in dramatic ways. We ought to recognize the times that we are in, but it ought to cause us to turn and rely more on God. Where's the water come from when you're walking through the puddles in New Orleans? Where do you get a drink if you're a Christian and God is your Lord and Master and you want to serve Him? Where does it come from? I told a story one time of a friend of mine, and he was in trouble, and he was doing something that he shouldn't have been doing, but he was in trouble, and he was leaving an area that had where somebody was looking for him. And he set out down a railroad track through the middle of a large, swampy, watery area where the railroad track was the only elevated piece of land across that part of that lake, or swamp, whichever it was. And he's kind of depressed, and he's crying out to God to help him, and he's walking along by himself, and he's fleeing. And he told me, he says, boy, I just wanted to go to the bathroom, and I'm out there in the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing there. And he thought, you know, if I just had some toilet paper. And he walks along a little bit, and he looks up there in the middle of the tracks, in the middle of the swamp, is a roll of toilet paper. Now, I know that sounds so stupid, but if you're out in the middle of a lake and it's all sewer and you want a drink of water, are you going to ask for the local Mountie to bring it in on his horse? I mean, what are you going to do? You have to be under God's care. How many examples in the Bible did God miraculously intercede for his people to give them something they needed, to answer prayer, to heal them, to bring them what they needed, to grant them some food? He offered Israel everything they needed, and Israel continued to fuss and complain. But he was willing to care for them. miraculously in the midst of wilderness, in the midst of slavery, in the midst of whatever circumstance they were in. We need to be under God's care. We don't know what our needs are going to be. We don't know how desperate our circumstances will be. But we're not going to be able to solve it by the power of our might or the intellect of our mind or the ability to set away savings. Andy Brunet and his family, they were church on the other end of the circuit. And this thing kind of played out the way it did, and he didn't have time to go home and gather up and take everything he wanted with him. They just had to keep going. They just left everything basically behind. Continued on their way. Matthew 24, verse 3. As he sat at the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, Christ here, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming, the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. Now, this is a process. I mean, how many times over the years have we gone through these scriptures? So we're talking about false Christianity, wars and rumors of wars. We're talking about a process of time over thousands of years here since the time of Christ, but we're also talking about something that culminates in the end time and Christ's return. Verse 7, nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in various places. And all these things are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation. So ultimately, we're talking the great tribulation. And it talks about false prophets in verse 13. He who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations. And then the end will come. So it isn't primarily talking about the time of the persecution of the church and the time of the apostles. It is ultimately going down to the finish of God's plan at this stage in terms of the harvest and whom God has prepared. It just says there'll be famines, there'll be pestilences, there'll be earthquakes in different places. And they will increase. And it won't be business as usual. And what are you going to do? I've read so many of the stories of the explosion in Mount St. Helens and who was camped out there and who was trying to get away and how somebody was driving down the road trying to stay ahead of the blast and how somebody else was running through the forest and it describes this big cloud just coming down and in some cases they ended up with their, you know, their camera equipment or something that was left behind. It's just a minimum of things that we're actually going to be able to do. One of my friends, when I worked in Pasadena, was very good with his finances and his money. And you know what? We should be good with our finances and our money. I'm certainly not going to recommend anyone to be careless in any way. But he was very careful for his investments, and he says, I want to have some gold when it comes time to throw it in the streets. He was just saying, this is good for now. Let's be responsible stewards. The time's going to come when it really won't matter. It's not going to work. And when the time comes, he says, I'll throw it in the streets. But until then, I'd like to have some. I thought that was responsible in a reasonable way. It is nice to say that we serve God out of love. I remember when that teaching came out that tithing was no longer required, that we would give God more out of love, and then the finances of the church kind of went down the toilet. Well, there was more reasons for that than just lack of love. But the fact is, I'd like to say that we serve God out of love because we want to respond to God. And I think we should. I think that's high, noble, and what God would want. But the fact is, don't you run just a little bit harder when you're being chased? Don't you? Okay? We have to do our part. And sometimes the incentive to do our part is greater than at other times. And we run a little harder. Proverbs 1. God didn't mean for us to be without incentive. Verse number 20. Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open square. She cries out in the chief concourses. At the opening of the gates of the city, she speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. So God said, look, I've been crying out, and people ignore me. They don't want to hear what I have to say. Turn it, my reproof. Surely I will pour out my spirit on you. I'll make my words known to you. Because I have called and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel, would have none of my reproof, I will also laugh at your calamity. I'll mock when your terror comes like a storm, and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you. We will always be dependent on God's mercy. But I would rather be able to go before God and not ask him to forgive me for my rebellion, now save me. I would rather go before him and ask to forgive me of my weakness. Please save me. Not because I had turned my back on him and ignored him and mocked him in some way, but because I had striven to serve him, but simply maybe to whatever degree had come short. We need to be under God's care. But we need to place ourselves in a position that we've been responsive to God. There's too much going on. The risks are too high. Verse 28, then they will call on me and I won't answer. They'll seek me diligently, but they will not find me. Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord, they would have none of my counsel and despised all my reproof. Therefore, they shall eat the fruit of their own way and be filled to the full with their own fancies. For the turning away of the simple will slay them, the complacency of fools will destroy them. But notice verse 33. But whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without fear of evil. So God just says, I've cried out and some people don't listen. And I've cried out and some people turn and put their hands over their ears. But those who do listen to me will dwell safely. I will be them, we with them. They will be under my care. Now when I read that, I can't take the book of Hebrews and take chapter 11 and throw it out the door. So Hebrews 11 shows by example, as well as in other places, there are those who have suffered in their service to God. So the one doesn't negate the other. But at least in Hebrews 11, you know it was by God's own direct allowance and choice, and not by their foolishness, or by their carelessness, or by their ignorance, by their own choice. It was because God allowed it for his greater purpose. If we suffer under God's care by his choice, and not by our own lack of righteousness, then at least we still fulfill his will. There's too many things that are happening around us, brethren, for us to not be under God's care. We have to do our part. But I don't want to be dependent on me doing my part to save myself from the troubles to come. I don't want to be in a position where I have to do that. But let's still do our part, as far as that goes. We were in the backpacking trip a little while back. Christina Crane and I were visiting, talking. She had been to ABC. She was in Cincinnati. She was in a car out on the highway, and the road construction had narrowed it down in the lanes, and they had cones out to the side, and basically come down to a stop. And I was talking to her. In fact, I called her this morning just to reconfirm what she had told me, so I got it correct. And she said she had this thought come into her mind, and it said, look behind you, you are going to be hit. And she looked up in the rearview mirror, and here's a large vehicle behind her, a great big vehicle coming in, and had not even begun to slow down, just flying in without paying attention, apparently right behind her. She took the car and put it in gear and literally drove through the cones off to the side to get out of the way, and she had room between her and the car in front because she had slowed down and left space, and the car slid past where she was and stopped before hitting the car that was in front, but literally slid past her trying to stop. Now, what if she hadn't moved out of the way? She could say, well, that wasn't my fault. Here I am. What did you expect me to do? So she did what she had to do, but you know, it was God, or through an angel, or through the way he works with her mind, you would have to understand and believe, that said, look behind you, you're about to be hit. She said she frantically looked up to see what was wrong because of what had come into her mind, and here was a car barreling up behind her. And because she took her action as well, she was spared. I don't want to be sitting on the freeway or in the middle of the hurricane path or next to Mount Rainier or some other disaster waiting to happen and God won't speak to my mind. I don't want to be in a position like that. I want to be under His care. I'm going to need it. I'm sure we all need it. But we need to keep ourselves in that place. 1 Peter 3 in verse number 8, I don't think these are normal times. I don't think they're going to be normal times in the future. How many think that the price of gasoline is going to go back down to where it used to be? What was it a year ago? Half of what it is today, a year ago. I tell you, I don't think you have to be a prophet to say it'll never go back to where it was before. Life has changed. September 11th, life change. 1995 or maybe 1993 or whatever it was in the church, life has changed. Things have gone on and they're different and they're never going back. China is rising up as an economic and political and military power in a way that did not used to exist. India is rising up in terms, I call on a computer and you know who I'm talking to. I'm speaking to someone in India. Hello? With a British accent in India answering my service call. It will never go back to where it was. Other people want a piece of the pie, and they want the aluminum, and they want the concrete, and they want the steel, and they want the gasoline, and they're willing to bid for it in order to compete with us, and some of it is going to go to those places. In fact, more than has ever been there before. You know, Wes, you build all kinds of stuff. I wonder, do you have any problem ever getting supplies, or is it all just laying there in big piles waiting to be used? You know? I think we all, hopefully, know better than that. 1 Peter 3, verse number 8. All of you, be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil, reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. For he who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking guile. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it because the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. His ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. I want God to hear my prayers. I want God to look on me and to guide my steps and to have mercy on me so that I can function and so that I can care for the things that I have to care for and so that I can one day hopefully be indeed in His kingdom. I want to be under His care. One of the memos that came in on the storm from Larry Salyer, Lisa Burnett, Andy's wife, is the Salyer's daughter, and so they've had communication in that way, and he put a couple of memos out to let us know what had taken place. He said a member, an area, or a friend at least had made it back to the neighborhood where the Burnett's home was to check on it. There's still people in some of these areas, and their home was still standing. In fact, he said it wasn't flooded even. The water, he said, came right up to the threshold of the door and never flooded the house. That's interesting. Remarkable coincidence. Now, does that apply to everybody, everywhere, with every home? I can't say that. We don't know where everybody is. And we can't play God and demand God to respond in some specific way. But his house was still standing, and the water came right up to the base of the foundation and went no further. I think I'm going to hang around him some. I'd like, you know, put my house next to his maybe someday. Yeah, I think he's doing something. Maybe God has blessed and cared for him in a particular way. I'm grateful to see that. Psalm 91. You know, we've looked at these scriptures over the years. Sooner or later, it's not a matter of looking at them in the future. It's going to be looking at them in the present. I think that time is obviously a little closer than what we thought in the past. There's some very dramatic things taking place. Do you think Islam as a unifying force in opposition to Western society is just going to give up and go away? I don't think so. Is the Catholic Church going to somehow just acquiesce and not try to consolidate their power and authority in Europe in some way and oppose, indeed, the Islamic threat to the South? I don't think so. Those things are on their way, and if you can't read them in your news today, you'll read them in your news tomorrow. It's a very current and present thing. Psalm 91, "He who abides in the secret place, the Most High, shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler, from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked." You're going to see it. You're going to see the damage and destruction in some cases, even while God has turned and protected you. "Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your habitation, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near to your dwelling. He shall give His angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. They shall bear you up in their hands, lest you dash your foot against a stone." Obviously, some of this is prophetic, specifically prophetic, even to Jesus Christ. "You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion, the serpent, you shall trample underfoot." When Paul was bitten by a poisonous snake and God had work for him to do, did he die from the snake? Or was there no impact at all? Now, we don't play with snakes because we don't feel like we have quite the license to do so, but when Paul had work to do and he was bitten by a poisonous snake, there was no impact at all. "The young lion serpent you shall trample underfoot. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him with long life. I will satisfy him and show him my salvation." Again, Hebrews 11 is still there, but I think we have to keep that in context and understand we need to be under God's care. With the righteous, God always decides. The choice is in His hands. Exodus 15. I think it's a pretty interesting passage in the same respect. Exodus 15 and verse 22. "Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they couldn't drink the waters of Marah because they were bitter." Not just bitter, poisonous. "Therefore the name of it was called Marah, and the people murmured against Moses, 'What shall we drink?' So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them. He said, 'If you diligently heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in His sight, give ear to His commandments and keep all His statutes.'" If you'll do what you have to yourself, if you'll respond to me, not because you're perfect, but because you're willing and you're striving to serve me. You know, the blood of Jesus Christ is for our weakness and our sin. "I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, it is I, the Lord, who heals you." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the waters. Now you can take, "I'll bring none of the diseases which I brought on the Egyptians." I guess you can expand that into a very broad perspective, but let's just look at it in this context. They came to a place that had water they couldn't drink. And God said, "Okay, I will give you water, and I won't make you sick." And they moved, and there was more water where they were going from there forward. God will give us what we need. and he'll do it, if need be, in a miraculous way, by the kindness of a stranger or a friend, by changing what it is that we do have to where we can use it, but we need to be under his care. He says, if you diligently heed to my voice, do what is right, give ear to my commandments, keep the statutes, then I will take care of you. You can trust me to do what needs to be done. World News and Prophecy, back in July, had an article, America's Handwriting of Warning. And it had a couple of comments that I thought were striking. He said, God overthrew Babylon in one night with the Persian army. One night, Babylon went down. Egypt was crippled when its army went to the bottom of the Red Sea. There was a process with all the plagues and the destruction of the social structure and economy of Egypt, but the army went down in a moment, and Egypt was destroyed. And then it says, could America's global dominance end in a similar fashion? Oh yeah, I can think of a number of ways. They talked about setting off a thermonuclear device in the air that basically fries the electrical circuits of what makes this nation function. You know, if there was a nuclear bomb in a suitcase, you put it in New York Harbor or San Francisco Harbor or Seattle Harbor and set the thing off, you shut down the economy of the nation in a significant way. Do you remember when the longshoremen on the West Coast went on strike a couple of years back? We're talking a few hundred people shut down shipping on the entire, I forget how many ports that covered, but it covered at least the northwestern ports, and I don't remember if it went down into California. But they just shut down the whole place. All you'd have to do is just one little thing like that, and the impact on this nation would be dramatic. New Orleans is one of the busiest ports in the country with all the shipping that goes up and down the Mississippi from that point. And the oil rigs that are out there and the petroleum that is pulled in from the Gulf is a huge proportion of all the domestic production that we have. It's an incredible circumstance. And the risks of the situation we live in now is very, very great. Does anybody want to face that on their own? By the power of your strength, by the intellect, your wisdom, by the resources, by the preparation. You got grain in the basement, you got water in a tank, you got some reserves in your house, and your house is washed away, and you have nothing. I'm headed back to Nigeria in November, and I wanted to go back in September, but Mr. Franks was available to go, and he is a very, very fine individual and teacher. And there was the need to do some seminar presentations for some of the groups, work with the leaders of groups that are wanting to be with United and work together and be in unity in that way. And so we moved it to when he was free, and then he was selected to replace Mr. Pinelli in church administration, and now he can't go. So I'm looking at the seminars, and I'm going, I don't know. I'm going to do 3 days of seminars where I do classes all through each day. And on. I mean, when Mr. Kellers and I were there, Mr. Schurter, we could kind of trade off, and you'd prepare for certain subjects, and one would speak, and the other would kind of prepare his material mentally as well. Then you'd speak, and you could trade off, and then you could answer the questions. You had a team of individuals there to answer the questions. So, you know, there are other things that need to be accomplished there. So I'm not sure to what degree I'm going to try to personally take that on, but I do know this. When I go over there now, maybe I'm going this time now by myself, and I'm not that smart to be able to say, oh, I know the answer to that. Let me teach you about this. I can help you in this case. I'm not that smart. I don't have that much knowledge. I want to be under God's care. I want God to work with my mind when I have to answer someone's question. I want him to give me the compassion that I need to have for the people who are there in their circumstances. I want to have what I need to do the job, and I don't take it with me. I know God has to add that to me for that work to properly be done the way it needs to be. Look at Matthew 10. I don't want to be on my own. I don't want to have to figure it out by myself. Matthew 10, verse 16. These were when Christ had called the disciples to him and sent them out, and he's sending them out as teachers. And again, the passage here, it's important just to see that we are not on our own, but we don't want to be. It takes more. Verse 16, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it's not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. A brother will deliver a brother to death, father his child, children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved." Again, we're talking a prophecy that applied very specifically to the people in that day and the persecutions on the church that came, but it also goes down into an end time circumstance of those who would be called on to give answer for God. Now, I realize this is in the context of persecution, but my point goes back. The first time I got to visit and speak to Bonnie Okolo's congregation, which was the 500 people at the feast, I didn't have any way to prepare. I didn't have any way to use notes. When I spoke to the leaders of his group afterwards and they were asking questions, I had no way to know what those questions would be. And it was an entirely different group of individuals. It wasn't me at a Bible study with you, and I could say, well, I'll get back to you on that point. Yeah, I'll see you in a year and a half. And I was so grateful afterwards, recognizing that God gave me what it was, at least as best that I could understand. He gave me what I needed to say. I want to be under God's care. I need that. We all need that. We don't need it just for what we speak. We need it for the drink of water someday, wherever that might be. And I don't want to be dependent on the fact that I have solved and prepared for and somehow solved that problem by myself. Because we're going to be in situations at some point where those things will simply be beyond our means. We need to be under God's care. These are perilous times. These are not normal times. Even if it was a normal time, we needed to be under God's care, but how much more do we need that now? God says, the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. The ears are open to his cry, or his ears are open to their cry. We need to make sure, brethren, that we have submitted ourselves to God, that we learn to trust and rely on God, because we need to be under his care.